Schönen Nachmittag bei einer neuen Folge der Philosophischen Brocken. Wir bringen einen Vortrag aus dem 30. Internationalen Wittgenstein-Symposium August diesen Jahres, und zwar einen Vortrag von Newton Garver. Newton Garver, der emeritierter Professor an der State University of New York at Buffalo ist, hat schon am ersten Wittgenstein-Symposium vor 31 Jahren einen Vortrag gehalten und signalisiert eine Kontinuität dieser Veranstaltung. Newton Garver ist international bekannter Wittgenstein-Experte mit einigen Büchern über Wittgenstein. Er ist aber auch politisch aktiv, und zwar ausgehend von seiner Überzeugung als Quaker. In dieser Eigenschaft hat er vor kurzem ein Buch geschrieben, The Limits of Power, Some Friendly Reminders. Für Friendly Reminders muss man im Auge behalten, dass die Quaker einander Friends nennen. Es ist also inhaltlich gerichtet an seine Glaubensgenossen und beschäftigt sich mit einer ganzen Reihe von Fragestellungen und Problemen, die im Moment in der US-amerikanischen Politik prominent sind, insbesondere dem Irakkrieg, dem Pentagon, der Verhetzung und Täuschung durch die Massenmedien, denen in den USA viele Personen unterlegen sind. Sein Vortrag ist schwerpunktmäßig an Wittgenstein orientiert, endet aber mit einer Reflexion, die zu tun hat mit diesem politischen Engagement. Der Titel des Vortrags hieß Grammar und Silence und zeigt an dieser Stelle den Bezug auf die beiden Wittgensteinschen Hauptwerke, wenn man das so sagen kann, den Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus und die philosophischen Untersuchungen. Der Tractatus ist bekannt für seine Endaussage, die mit Schweigen zu tun hat. Weniger bekannt ist, dass die philosophischen Untersuchungen und ihre Konzentration auf grammatische Untersuchungen ebenfalls mit Schweigen verbunden werden können. Das kommt daher, dass, wie Newton Garver ausführt, Grammatik und grammatische Untersuchungen eine Unternehmung sind, die nicht nach Inhalten aus ist, sondern nach der Abmessung und Klärung von grammatischen Tatsachen, nach denen dann nichts mehr gesagt werden muss, weil Klärung erreicht ist. Ganz besonders legt Newton Garver Wert darauf, dass es sich nicht um die Suche nach Wahrheit handelt, Wahrheit im Sinn einer Erkundung neuer Tatsachen oder neuer Einsichten, die in der Philosophie eine ganz besondere Doktrin etablieren würden. Es geht darum, eine übersichtliche Darstellung zu gewährleisten, und nachdem diese Aufgabe erfüllt ist, ist, so der späte Wittgenstein, die Aufgabe des Philosophen oder der Philosophin erreicht.
I will today be continuing to talk about the matter of clarification as the work of philosophy, under the title Grammar and Silence. A handout has gone around. I will read parts of this, but not read other parts, and occasionally tell you where I am by the numbers on the handout. But the problem I'm dealing with is a problem that arises because of Wittgenstein's commitment to the work of philosophy as a work of clarification. That is, not as a kind of search for truth or an attempt to find wisdom. Wittgenstein's early masterpiece, the Tractatus, culminates in silence, as nearly everybody knows, with the famous sentence, "Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen." What we cannot speak about, we must consign to silence. Wittgenstein's return to philosophy after a dozen years of silence, in the sense of withdrawing from any prominent philosophical discussion, raises the question whether, in his own life, he went against the silence that he had proclaimed at the end of the Tractatus and began to speak things which could not be spoken. The plan of my paper is very simple. I want to begin first by discussing silence, saying what is and what is not contained within the silence that is proclaimed at the end of the Tractatus. The second part of Wittgenstein's work he often referred to as grammar. And making grammatical remarks is something that constitutes a constant activity in a certain sense. The second part of my paper will discuss what is and what is not included within the word grammar as Wittgenstein uses it. And toward the end of my paper, I will make what seems to me a fairly obvious point, and that is that the silence of the Tractatus is inherent to the work of clarification, and it does not matter whether the technique of clarification is the logical analysis of the Tractatus or the grammatical clarification of the later work. In either case, what is avoided and what cannot be presented in the course of philosophical work is pronouncements about the world or about behavior. So that the silence, in the sense in which Wittgenstein meant it originally, is preserved and refined, one might say, rather than abandoned by his later work. Let me now turn to the question of silence. Wittgenstein's silence is, of course, not an absence of noise, not even an absence of verbalization. The silence applies only to what we cannot speak about. And Wittgenstein is entirely clear that there are things that we can speak about, in particular, the matters of fact which he assigns to science. So that when Wittgenstein's silence is proclaimed, it is explicitly limited to what we cannot speak about. This interpretation I take to be uncontroversial and accepted by anybody who has looked at Wittgenstein's Tractatus. I want to read the passages that come just before the final words. The correct method in philosophy would be the following: to say nothing of what except what can be said, that is, propositions of natural science, that is, something that has nothing to do with philosophy. And then, whenever someone else wanted to say something metaphysical, to demonstrate to him that he had failed to give meaning to certain signs in his propositions. Although it would not be satisfying to the other person, he would not have the feeling that we were teaching him philosophy, this method would be the only strictly correct one. My propositions serve as elucidations in the following way. Anyone who understands me eventually recognizes them as nonsensical, and when he has used them as steps to climb beyond them, he must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he's climbed up it. He must transcend these propositions, and then he will see the world aright. Wittgenstein does not make such a clear distinction between philosophical doctrine and philosophical clarification as he does between philosophy and science. Is there such a distinction? I believe the passage just cited indicates that there is a distinction. Metaphysics would constitute philosophical doctrine, and Wittgenstein says that it is still the sort of thing he wants to do, to show to someone who tries to speak metaphysics that he has failed to give meaning to some of his words. That would be a matter of philosophical clarification. Wittgenstein in the Tractatus does not give examples of how this would be done, and I'm not going to try to give an example here. It certainly is not easy to see how you show another person that there is an absence of meaning for a sign or word that that other person has used. And yet that's the sort of thing that must be done if we are to pursue the philosophy and the philosophical method that Wittgenstein describes here at the end of the work. Earlier in the Tractatus, he had said that philosophy is not a doctrine but an activity. And it's not going to be an easy activity, but it does seem to me that it will involve not only gestures but also words. So there will be verbalization of a sort that comes in the course of the philosophical elucidations or clarifications, and these words will not break the silence that he talks about. The sanction for violating the silence. Wittgenstein speaks in the final sentence in a modal form. Darüber muss man schweigen. We must confine that to silence. And the must is, of course, not a purely descriptive word. It's a moral word, and the question is, why must we? What is the sanction for violating the silence that is guarded by this modal word? And the answer is that it is not a moral sanction at all. It is not a punishment. It is just that if you attempt to say anything metaphysical, it turns out that your sentences don't say anything at all. That is, they are nonsense. Wittgenstein's conception of nonsense is powerful and important, and he uses it here. He says that anybody who has understood me, notice, he does not say anyone who has understood the propositions of the Tractatus. Anyone who has understood me will recognize them, the propositions of the Tractatus, as nonsense. So Wittgenstein takes his having presented the Tractatus in the form as it is as being exactly an instance of the exercise he urges upon other people in the course of philosophical elucidation. It is a showing to other people. Not a here he says it, but he says you have to understand me, and that primarily means you have to understand what I have been showing you. Using the distinction between showing and staying that's so prominent in the Tractatus. So the sanction is a logical and not a moral sanction. The must in the final sentence is a logical, not a moral must. It conforms then to Wittgenstein's remark in Tractatus 6.37, there is only logical necessity. The necessity at the end, again, is a logical necessity. So, Proposition 7 is a platitude. It is, in other words, simply a logical truth. It does not say anything. No logical truth says anything. And therefore, as you know, he regards logic as lacking sense. Just as, although perhaps not in exactly the same way as metaphysics lacks sense. What the lacking of sense, the senselessness of logic has in common with metaphysics is that neither one of them succeeds in saying anything. And if you don't say anything, that's the same as remaining silent. And Wittgenstein's notion of silence is intrinsically connected then with this business of not saying anything or of your utterances being without sense or being nonsense. Now, some of the commentators, as you know, have said that that's the end of the matter, but the mysticism in the Tractatus is palpable. And it's clear enough already in the passages that I've read where Wittgenstein says that recognizing certain propositions as nonsense enables you to see the world aright. Now, seeing the world aright is something really significant, and that means that the silence isn't really the end of the matter. Wittgenstein, indeed, has made that even more explicit in 6.522. There are indeed things that cannot be put into words. They make themselves manifest. They are what is mystical. There is a tension between the logical analysis that ends up in silence, as if there's nothing else, and this palpable mysticism. I won't have anything more to say about that today, except this, that Wittgenstein seems to have regarded the search for clarity and avoiding nonsense as a very high moral duty, almost as a religious quest. And therefore, when he says that we must consign it to silence, even though that is a platitude, it also marks something for him that was of deep moral or religious significance. Later on, when he came back to philosophy, fairly early in 1930, in a preface that he drafted for what's been published as the Philosophical Grammar, he said, as Matthias Gross took for the title of his Habilitation Schrift, that he believed in clarity for its own sake, Klarheit als Selbstzweck, an extraordinary commitment when you think about it. In that particular passage, he distinguished himself from scientists who seek clarity so that they can have definitive experiments. That's not my clarity, he says. I want clarity for its own sake, not for the sake of some other objective or end or project. And I have a sense that the mysticism of the Tractatus has a moral element that is connected with the way Wittgenstein wanted to lead his life. So let me just say it at that and move on then to the second part of the paper having to do with grammar. I have as a presupposition to my paper today my understanding of Wittgenstein as having retained his conception of the work of philosophy being a work of clarification, and hence as clarity, with language in particular, clarity being a very high end. Holding this part of Wittgenstein's work constant, we see, as everybody has noted, that there is a radical change between the Tractatus and his later work. He has a different conception of what clarity is, and a different, radically different conception of how to go about the work of clarification. The work of clarification was achieved in the Tractatus by means of logical analysis, in particular truth-functional analysis, and the techniques that he developed for truth-functional analysis in the Tractatus are still used in elementary logic courses in universities around the world. It's extraordinarily powerful stuff. But in the later work, in truth-functional analysis, logical analysis of any kind is given up. I don't believe that means that it is never appropriate, but Wittgenstein had nothing more to say about it, and it isn't the most significant way to go about achieving clarification. Wittgenstein, in part, in order to note and take acknowledge this difference, spoke about his later work as grammar and referred to what he was saying in the course of clarification as making grammatical remarks. G. E. Moore attended his lectures at Cambridge from 1930 to 1933, and in Moore's write-up of those lectures, he records having asked Wittgenstein the question about what grammar is. Moore reported to Wittgenstein that he, Moore, did not understand how Wittgenstein was using the word. And Wittgenstein replied with what is perhaps a characteristic lack of accommodation, "I am using the word in its ordinary sense, but making it apply to things it doesn't ordinarily apply to." Got it? Of course, if meaning is use, as Annette told us yesterday, that's a contradiction in terms. I am using the word in its ordinary sense, but applying it to things it doesn't ordinarily apply to simply gets in an inextricable tangle. And one thing I would like to do in this part of the paper is untangle that a little bit. The word grammar could be understood in its broadest sense as a description of a language. In the very broadest sense, and of course, in that broad sense, it is also very vague. It isn't at all clear what's going to be entailed in the description of a language. The early uses of the word grammar in English restricted grammar to morphology and syntax. Morphology being the different variations of a word, for example, the declensions of nouns and conjugations of verbs, and syntax having to do with the order of words in sentences. The reason why morphology and syntax were the central branches of grammar is that grammar always meant grammar of Latin and Greek, and the word was not applied to living languages in the 16th and early 17th century. In the 17th century, the word grammar began to be applied in English, to French in particular, a living language. And there got to be a further dimension of grammar beyond morphology and syntax, namely phonology, the sound patterns of the language. The sound patterns of the language introduces something radically different from the morphology and syntax. And the difference can be explained by using terminology of the Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure, who worked at the end of the 19th into the 20th century. His classic book is Notes that student took in his courses, and it's published as Cours de Linguistique Générale. Saussure uses a fundamental distinction between what he calls langue and what he calls parole. Both langue and parole would be translated in English as language or speech. Perhaps you could distinguish langue as language and parole as speech. Both of them would, of course, be Sprache in German. The distinction for Saussure has to do with whether or not the part of the language that you are describing is independent of the actual use of the language. And if it is, you're describing the langue. If what you're doing is describing the actual employment of the language as it is spoken, then you are moving beyond langue and discussing parole. In the 20th century, the ability to record and analyze sounds by means of a sound spectrograph using, you might say, a branch of physics, became very sophisticated. But the linguists still insist that no matter how sophisticated the use of physics is, you cannot effectively describe the sound patterns of a language by means of physics. What Saussure did was to introduce the notion of a phoneme. And phonemes are sounds significant in a language. What you cannot detect in any physical means is the significance. And the significance is something that depends upon the recognition of speakers of either identity, though that's not always so important or easy, or difference, and difference is always significant. And in English, there's a difference between a P and B at the beginning of a word. So we have the word P and the word B. Those are two different words. In Arabic, there is no difference between P and B. There isn't any P in Arabic as a phoneme, though the sound occurs. The Arabic word for elementary is ibtidai. Now, you heard a P at the beginning, ibtidai. Any Arab hears that as a B. And it only sounds like a P because the next letter is a voiceless consonant, namely T. I had an utter disaster in attempting to teach an Arab student one time to say Pepsi-Cola. it came out as Pepsi-Cola. And I said, no, 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 you have to say the Bay in the first, Pepsi-Cola. Or Pepsi-Cola, you only, sorry. Anyway, you get the point. He kept saying Pepsi-Cola instead of Pepsi-Cola. And that's because in learning language, he had learned the sounds which are significant in Arabic. And the sounds significant in Arabic are different from those significant in English or German or Italian. There are some similarities between Arabic and Italian. If you have a double consonant in Italian, you can hear the double consonant as different from the single consonant, so that capella is different from capella. And in Arabic, hammam is different from hammam. Most of you didn't hear the difference. But these phonemic things are extremely important, and it was the identification of phonemes by Saussure that enabled linguistics in the 20th century to be so effective in describing languages. I've spent some time on that because what I want to say is that Wittgenstein's reference to language games and to uses of language is again a reference to parole and not to langue. I think all of you who have read Wittgenstein will recognize that he wants to emphasize the speaking of a language, and indeed he italicizes the word speaking when he introduces the word language game. One of the reasons why it is difficult to understand what Wittgenstein is doing as a kind of grammar is just because he is now applying techniques of the description of language where they have not been applied before. And in that respect, I think that his remark to Moore, although Moore didn't get it, and most readers don't get it, I think it is a correct remark about what he is doing. The techniques that are used to describe phonemes are mainly techniques of contrast and to some extent also techniques of exemplification. But contrast is what is vital. And if you take a course in phonology or phonemics, you will find that what's important in a language is the contrast. And you can't get the phonemes of a language until you get the whole pattern of contrasts that are significant in that language. Linguists tell us that every natural language has between 20 and 60 phonemes. Never more, never fewer. So there's a very finite number of phonemes that linguists identify by names of these contrasts. The other technique that they use to describe phonemes is distinctive feature analysis. And that's where the phonemes in a given cluster of phonemes are said to have a distinctive feature, and a sort of an untechnical characteristic would be that the phoneme in question is a stop. That is to say, there is an actual cessation of the breath at a certain point. A stop compares with a sibilant. S and F are sibilants, and the breath doesn't actually stop the way it is with stops. Well, those distinctive features are helpful, and there are a variety of others. what I would say is that Wittgenstein uses these methods, namely contrast and distinctive feature analysis, in order to identify language games. And that's essential to the kind of grammar that he's doing, to the work of clarification. He said to Drury at one time that he could use a remark from King Lear, "I'll teach you differences," as a motto for his work. And the differences are fundamental. If you remember, his remark that Annette referred to yesterday, comparing knowing and saying, how many feet high Mont Blanc is, how the word game is used, how a clarinet sounds. If you're surprised that one can know something and not be able to say it, you perhaps are thinking of a case like the first, certainly not like the third. What he does here is to contrast three different cases. Mainly, he contrasts knowing how high Mont Blanc is with knowing how high a clarinet sounds. And he puts an intermediate case in, knowing the rules for using the word game. We know he doesn't now provide any analysis. He doesn't provide any reasons lying behind this contrast. He lays the contrast out in front of us. The same thing is done in section 23, which is in a way a summary of the opening paragraphs of or pages of the Philosophical Investigations. He has contrasted different uses of language, put the uses of language in as part of the behavior of a tribe. In section 2, he asks us to imagine that those four words are the whole language of a tribe. And then he says, how many kinds of sentence are there? Say, assertion, question, and command. There are countless kinds, countless different kinds of use, Verwendung, of what we call symbols, words, sentences. And this multiplicity is not something fixed, given for once and all, but new types of language, new language games, as we may say, may come into existence and others become obsolete and get forgotten. Here, the term language game is meant to bring into prominence the fact that the speaking of language is part of an activity or of a form of life. Review the multiplicity of language games in the following examples and in others. Giving orders and obeying them. Describing the appearance of an object or giving its measurements. Constructing an object from a description or a drawing. Reporting an event, speculating about an event, forming and testing a hypothesis, presenting the results of an experiment in tables and diagrams, making up a story and reading it, play acting, singing catches, guessing riddles, making a joke, telling it, solving a problem in practical arithmetic, translating from one language to another, asking, thanking, cursing, greeting, praying. And in 25, he adds, commanding, questioning, recounting, chatting. What he is doing here is not giving us a complete list of anything, but asking us to notice that it's possible to distinguish these different uses of language, these different activities in which language plays a role. Note that he has said that the uses of language, the language games, are countless, zahllos. He does not say that they are infinite. If they were infinite, you might begin counting them and not being able to finish. The point about their being countless is that you can't even begin. If you look at that list and say, well, is perhaps one of them included in another? He'll shake his shoulders and say, perhaps. You make distinctions and contrasts where they're important, but you don't have the kind of identity of uses of language or identity of language games that enables you even to begin counting. I want to call your attention to a somewhat more subtle distinction that he makes between feelings and emotions. Feelings are sensations. Emotions are different, and he talks about grief and love as emotions and says that you might say of grief or love, that couldn't have been grief. It lasted only 10 minutes. But you couldn't say that sort of thing about pain or another sensation. What happens here is that Wittgenstein pays explicit attention to the discourse continuations that are allowed by, or not allowed, by the distinction between sensation and emotion. When you look at the contrast in the context of discourse and speech, the two things that are most important in distinguishing one language game from another are the context in which it is appropriate and the discourse continuations which are allowed or disallowed by identifying the particular language game in question. I'm now going to turn to the end of my paper and and note that a dozen years ago here at Kirchberg, Arnulf Zweig read a paper in which he rebuked Wittgenstein for making no comments about the Holocaust. And he said this was a moral failure on Wittgenstein's part. I want to say that I have been very troubled by Zweig's remark, but I can't feel that it's just. Wittgenstein's commitment is an unusual commitment. It's a commitment to clarity for its own sake, and that is to a steadfast and pure commitment to clarification being the work of philosophy. And if clarification is the work of philosophy, you are not going to make judgments or pronouncements, even about the Holocaust. And I see, therefore, Wittgenstein's not making a remark about the Holocaust as a kind of faithfulness to his philosophical integrity as he saw it to the work of clarification. As much as I admire Wittgenstein for this, I must say that I am not easy with this. I believe that the work of philosophy is clarification. As a philosopher, I don't think I have anything to say that is of more moral weight than what anyone else has to say. But on the other hand, as a human being, I am not inclined to limit myself simply to the work of clarification. I see Wittgenstein's adopting clarity as an end in itself, as a monkish, religious kind of commitment. I have to admire that. But at the same time, I have to say that I'm uneasy with it. I share in that respect the unease that Arnold Zweig and Russell had with this aspect of Wittgenstein's commitment to the work of philosophy as he has seen it. Thank you. The power of Wittgenstein's philosophy and what makes Wittgenstein's philosophy, what gives it a place in history, is his commitment to the work of philosophy being clarification. And if the work of philosophy is clarification, its aim is not truth or knowledge. And to give up the search for truth and the search for knowledge is an extraordinary innovation in philosophy. Wittgenstein insists that philosophy can achieve power and integrity only by limiting itself in this way. And he takes the notion of clarification in the early work as limiting, as more or less identifying philosophy with logic, as Russell had done. Russell, however, regarded logic as a science, and Wittgenstein departed from Russell dramatically by not regarding logic as a science. It's only a tool for clarification. And logical truths are not truths. They don't say anything. So they are a kind of nonsense. And this removal from the pursuit of truth in the Tractatus is something which is continued in his later work by his identification of philosophy with grammar. Grammar cannot possibly be foundational. Grammar is inherently secondary, not primary. You cannot do grammar until there's already some language to describe. The language comes first, the grammar is second. And to insist that the work of philosophy is a secondary, not a primary work, is again a kind of limitation that Wittgenstein regards as essential for realizing the power that is inherent in this particular discipline. I share Wittgenstein's view that the work of philosophy is clarification, and that that requires a renunciation as philosophers of a search for truth, a wisdom. That's the sense of power that I see involved. My sense of the perils is that Wittgenstein has taken such a monkish attitude that, as a public person at any rate, he's not willing to be anything but a philosopher. And therefore has so little to say about the times in which he lived or through which he lived. It's quite extraordinary. He lived through two world wars, a depression, a Holocaust, extraordinary things. And we find that he has nothing, almost nothing to say. Do I have anything to say? Yes, in this book on the limits to power, I talk about the abuses of language that occur in public life. I think the abuses of language in public life are just awful. I'm prepared to quote Wittgenstein at times, as I suggest in the handout, saying, there's only logical necessity. And I'm prepared to say that to George Bush when he says, etc. There isn't a politician who doesn't hide behind necessity. And there are all too few intellectuals, philosophers, and others to raise questions about whether or not the necessities that are urged in public life are genuine necessities. That kind, to withdraw from that kind of exercise of public responsibility or activity in the public sphere seems to me one of the perils of the way Wittgenstein has taken his philosophy.
The first one has to do with clarification, being for you something that Wittgenstein does all along, or looking to clarification as the philosophical task. And we've been seeing interpreters lately talking a lot about therapy as being that connection between early and later Wittgenstein, or running along all of Wittgenstein's work. What is the connection, or do you see a connection between clarification and therapy? Not therapy, I think, in the sense of being a psychiatrist, but therapy as the therapeutes, or those interpreters of Wittgenstein who put therapy up there. And my second question comment, of course, has to do with the last part of your talk. You said clarity for clarity's sake as perhaps leading to a monkish attitude of not talking about the Holocaust, or for that matter about President Bush. But then you also said that you don't think that you could say anything as a philosopher, but rather as a human being, and that therefore what you say is no better than any other human being's judgment or comment. And it's nobly egalitarian to think that our comments about President Bush are no different or no better or no more enlightening than someone else who might be an electrician or a high techie or anything else. Aren't you saying what you're saying as a philosopher when you talk about necessity? Your contribution is made as a philosopher. Now, that you could say that that's because you have that training or that talent, but I'm wondering if you don't have that obligation as a philosopher. And when we talk about treason of the intellectuals or the academics or whoever, aren't we saying that we do have an obligation to someone as philosophers, that connection between ethics and logic, which we have, and I think what you're pointing at is a duty not just to oneself. But that was a long comment.
Well, that's a very tough question to end up with. Let me say with respect to therapy that I think that your question is tied in with the comments that Cameron made earlier, that very often what we see is a kind of sickness in the society around us or in human relations that can be cured by getting clear about what it is that we're talking about. And this business of mediating controversies by means of some sort of clarification, getting people to the point where they can indeed use words the same way, is a contribution that can be made. My own sense is that my obligations to do this sort of thing do not come from my being a philosopher. I am a Quaker, and I consider myself as having a religious commitment of sorts. It's a very different commitment from lots of other religious commitments, but nonetheless, it does involve some sort of responsibility toward the public domain. And I have a sense of what constitutes a healthy public domain and a sense of some of the difficulties. Sometimes my philosophical training helps me to see those things. And my sense is that the way that I approach those things is certainly not a way that I would say any other philosopher or even any other Quaker has an obligation to approach them. Now, each of us has certain distinct talents. Each of us has skills. Each of us is placed in a certain position where we have openings for us to do certain kind of work. This book that you mentioned, The Limits to Power, Some Friendly Reminders, it wouldn't exist without a colleague of mine having started a website called buffaloreport.com and invited his colleagues to make occasional contributions. Well, after I've made a dozen or so, he said, "Newton, couldn't we put these together as a book?" Well, I had no idea of anything like that. But having the opportunity to know that if I wrote something about my sense of living in a sea of idolatry, where it is not God that is our ultimate refuge and strength, but is instead the Pentagon, with the Pentagon as a false idol, much worse than the golden calf of the Old Testament, I felt sort of free. I felt enabled to write this partly because I knew it would be published. And it seems to me something that was worth saying. Now, I don't expect that this is going to be noted as the contribution of a philosopher. And it's something that is written as a public person who, now I have philosophical training, but I mean the philosophical points are not significant so much as pointing out a certain kind of abuse of language. It certainly is true that those of us in philosophy are trained to become sensitive to abuses of language, and we just have to be open to the opportunities that we have. None of you has the kind of opportunity I have to publish that sort of thing and other things about necessity and so forth on this particular website. Well, you have other chances. At any rate, I do not look upon philosophical colleagues who do not comment as committing a kind of treason of the academics, the trahison des clercs, but rather instead have an admiration of those of you who find your own way to do a little something, whatever it is.